Leonard Davis is a disability studies scholar at the University of Illinois at Chicago. And just in time for the 25th anniversary of the ADA, he published his latest book, Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights. We met on Skype, and he taught me the real lesson in how a bill becomes a law. Our conversation began with the Section 504 of the Rehabilitative Act of 1973, where activism and legislation came together and essentially became the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Okay, so in the Rehabilitation Act of 1973, which is really basically designed to be a rehab act, at the time the president was Richard Nixon. And so the bill was passed in Congress and the Senate, and Nixon vetoed it. And then it was passed again. Then they tried to pass it again, and Nixon vetoed it again the second time because he didn't want the independent living funds in there. However, there was in the act something that nobody really noticed at the time. I mean, you know, with all the debate about the independent living funds, no one noticed that there was this little tiny section called 504. And Section 504, you know, hidden within this bill was just a tweet length Section 504, which nobody really noticed. And if you go back and look at the debates in Congress and so on, it's not mentioned at all. There's no legislative history on it. But it basically says that no otherwise qualified person could be denied their civil rights. So once the bill was passed, I don't know who noticed it or didn't notice it. But people realized that 504 was there. And like with any bill, there had to be regulations. So there was a long period of writing the regulations for Section 504. And it took such a long time. I think it took 7 years before it was the regulations were signed. And during that time, Nixon, as you know, left office. And then Carter came in. And there was kind of a feeling among people with disabilities that, yeah, with Carter, it would happen quickly. And it didn't happen particularly quickly. His Secretary of Health, HEW, Health, Education, and Welfare, Califano, just seemed to be sitting on it for a long time. And it was during this period, this is really when I think all of the disability groups banded together and we really get a sense that, yeah, there's this cross-country, cross-disability movement that begins. And so around the country in various places, there were a lot of protests, and culminating in the San Francisco protest, in which 100 people occupied the HEW building for, I think it's 28 or 29 days. It was the longest occupation of a federal building in U.S. history. And finally, Califano was forced to sign the regulations, and they went into effect. I think that you can date the concept of disability activism and a disability, cross-disability movement to that point. I mean, there were cross-disability organizations, but that's sort of like the flashpoint.
That is pretty incredible that something so short and small and seemingly, you know, invisible in this massive bill is what was the foundation for such a huge movement.
I know, it is. It's whimsical in a certain kind of way. And by the way, there's speculation about who put that in there, but there's no one has ever stepped forward and said, like, I did it. Yeah. I mean, we have a name of somebody, but that, as far as I know, that person... I was not able to locate that person, and it was probably an intern who was something like 20 years old and working. But yeah, it's you would think it that person should be enshrined in the Disability Hall of Fame, but really that's one of the stories. One of the things that interests me in this book that I wrote, Enabling Acts, is just the whimsical nature of the way that politics happen. You know, had that intern not put this in, there might not have been a pan-disability movement at exactly that time in that way.
These are such great stories that, I mean, with as much work I've been doing in this field, I had no idea. These are great stories. Did you have any other favorite stories from while you were writing this book or other adventures that came up along the way?
Because most people tell the story from the point of view of disability activism, but I was able to get memos and talk to people who are in the White House, and that gives us a whole other view of it. So anyway, the story that interests me is how this bill got going in the first place. What happened was that there were a group of people from Berkeley, part of the whole Berkeley independent living movement. You could say Berkeley activists, Berkeley hippies, who were part of this group called DREDIF, which was a spinoff from the Center for Independent Living. And DREDIF is the education and legal defense branch. And there was a woman named Pat Wright and another woman named Arlene Mayerson, a guy named Bob Funk, who just looked at each other one day in the middle of a meeting and said, let's go to Washington. I mean, literally like that. And the reason they went was because, you know, Reagan was in power at that point, and Reagan's whole thing was deregulation. So there was a lot of legitimate fear that you know, services and things that had been hard won under 504 were going to be rolled back. The first person whose floor they crashed on was a guy named Evan Kemp. And Evan Kemp came from a family of Democrats who were well known. He used a wheelchair. He went to law school, and he graduated at the top of his class and couldn't get a job. And so he began to be aware of the fact that there was this tremendous discrimination against people with disabilities, which I suppose he'd known all along. He approached Ralph Nader, and he started a Ralph Nader-Rader office in Washington on DuPont Circle. He had like a tiny two rooms and a big, in a couple of desks, and he basically gave his office to the Dredf people and let them sleep on his floor. Turns out that Evan Kemp was an extremely good bridge player. He had a Thursday night kind of Washington bridge game going, where a lot of, you know, some people came, and one of the people who came regularly was this guy named C. Boyden Gray. And he ended up being the legal counsel for Vice President George Bush, who at that time. So Kemp is playing every Thursday night with Boyden Gray. But in the course of that, he's also learning a lot about disability, because Kemp is telling him about his experiences. And so Pat Wright, who's friends with Kemp now, sleeping on his floor, starts talking to Boyden Gray. I mean, so this is like a weird connection, because Boyden Gray is a super neoconservative. So you got these like Berkeley hippies now with a direct connection to the interior of the White House through Boyden Gray. Well, when Bush gets elected president, Boyden Gray becomes the legal counsel. He is now one of the most powerful men in the United States, and he is passing information, talking to, and coordinating things with people like Pat Wright. So that's kind of fascinating, because people say like, oh, the Capitol crawl was really important. And I almost think like that bridge game was almost more important. I mean, had that bridge game not been going on, it's not clear that the disability activists would have ever been able to get any connections inside the White House. And by the way, Evan Kemp then transferred over and started working inside the White House as a result of that.
That is a really good story. And bridge game and couch surfing, like the old school Airbnb situation. You were talking about these hidden stories, and something that I was curious about in this 25th anniversary, I've been seeing a lot of social media posts and comments that the ADA and the movement kind of looked like a white movement, that there wasn't much representation from people of color with disabilities. Do you have any thoughts or comments about that?
Well, I think that's true. I mean, I know that during the Section 504 occupation in San Francisco that the Black Panthers were involved, or at least one or two were. But, you know, a lot of these people that I detail come from wealthy families, you know, and are white elite people. I think that provided a kind of cover for what is, in essence, a kind of radical piece of legislation. You know, I mean, Justin Dart is a good example of that. I mean, he was the heir to Walgreens fortune. So I think you needed to have this group of white, privileged, elite people to get this bill through Congress. I mean, I think that's true. However, I mean, one of the groups that was very important was Conference on Civil Rights that was headed by Ralph Neese. Ralph Neese is not a person of color, but the organization itself was the largest group of people of color and of various ethnicities in the country. It's a coordinating committee for every single group like NAACP, CORE. I mean, you go down the line, I think there were 125 organizations. And that group, under the leadership of Neese, but still, that group really made it possible to turn the legislation into something about civil rights. But on the other hand, there is an interesting somewhat of a conflict between African Americans and people with disabilities, that there's a tension there that was there. And let me just give you a couple of examples. One is that the Civil Rights Act of 1964, which we all know, was basically an act about people of color, ethnicities, and so on. I think a couple of years later, women were added to that. legislation. Hubert Humphrey decided that he wanted to add disability to that legislation, to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And there was a huge pushback from African Americans who did not want that. And they didn't want it because, A, they didn't want the bill watered down as they saw it with like a lot of other groups, but also that they legitimately were worried that if the bill came back to the Senate, that there could be a lot of damaging amendments, and they didn't want to do that. So there wasn't a strong alliance, I think, until the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights came along. So by the time you get to the late 1980s, there isn't this opposition anymore. And, you know, I mean, if you look at photographs, there are photographs from the marches. You see mainly white faces, but you do see black people as well.
Is there anything else? Any other topics we haven't talked about?
I mean, I really got to know better the role of the disability activist community, as well as a lot of people who are behind the scenes really organizing this, because this bill would have never happened had there not been tremendous coordination through all the states and through, getting people with disabilities to contact their congresspeople and senators. I mean, I think that is really important, and I think everybody should, you know, read about it and know about it. This 25th anniversary is important. There's a long way to go. There's a lot more to do. But, disability has become part of the U.S. in a way that it wasn't before. And we take so many things for granted now that were part of this act. Wheelchair lifts on buses, curb cuts, captioning on TV, relays for deaf people. I mean, these are things that are just part of the environment that we look at and just think we're always there. But I think one of the other messages here is that I asked almost all the politicians that I spoke to, Bob Dole, Orrin Hatch, Tom Harkin, all of the heavy hitters, and I said, do you think this bill could pass today? And every one of them said no.
Why did they feel that way?
Because this is bipartisan legislation. And it also really, you know, as I describe in the book, you had to have agreement between groups that normally don't agree with each other. I mean, you had to have business say that they were willing to do this. It's going to cost them money. It's going to inconvenience them to some degree. And you had people who are fighting for disability rights. Those are, mostly Democrats on the left. You know, the left and right had to come up with a compromise in bipartisanship. That bipartisanship doesn't exist anymore today. And one example of that is the UN Treaty on Disabilities, which has been signed and ratified by every country in the United States, except for the U.S. And we signed it, but we won't ratify it. And we won't ratify it because the left and right can't agree. The right thinks that this is going to be a UN treaty is going to impinge on the right of the U.S. government to have its own autonomy, which is completely not true. And Tea Party homeschoolers are saying, we don't want people telling us how to, you know, teach our disabled children. So that kind of unanimity is over. I mean, Bob Dole, who was a big supporter of the ADA, now is in his 90s and is very frail, came on the floor of the Senate last year and said, please pass this bill, and nobody would.
Yeah, I remember that, and that's a good point. It's sad to think we're in that current state of affairs.
Yep.
Leonard Davis, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me for Intersections Radio.
Well, my pleasure, and thanks. It was a good conversation.
That was Leonard Davis, author of Enabling Acts, The Hidden Story of How the Americans with Disabilities Act Gave the Largest U.S. Minority Its Rights. This was an abbreviated interview, and you can listen to the extended version at intersectionsradio.wordpress.com. I'm Sarika Mehta, and this is Intersections Radio.